This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the Sleep Angels over at Casper.com. It's time for a new mattress. Go to Casper.com/FamilyHour and use offer code FamilyHour and get $50 off a brand new mattress that hasn't been infected with the life ooze of you, your lovers, and your dogs and cats and animals. Hello, dear friends. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you have joined the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. To all newcomers, we welcome you with multiple arms stretching out from multiple torsos and a wide array of arms and torsos and ears and noses and eyeballs. At this very moment, you have tuned in to a community of people all over the planet who are listening to my raspy lesbian voice ramble, and I am incredibly grateful that you have made the decision to come swimming in the digital pond of this podcast when there's so many other podcasts out there. My God, a billion trillion podcasts have emerged. We're talking the Cambrian explosion of podcasts has happened. An incredible expulsion of ideas, thoughts, conversations. Some of them good, some of them maybe not that great, but they're developing. I gotta tell you, one thing I really don't like are the podcast haters. And that's not just because my main job is that of a podcaster, but because what ends up happening is all the people out there who have the inkling of desire to have a podcast don't do it because they saw this person tweet about how there's too many podcasts, or they heard that person yap about how the market is oversaturated. There's always someone out there who's going to do something like that. And they're not necessarily evil, nefarious, or dark people. They're not intentionally attempting to put their calloused heel on the garden hose of creativity that has emerged from the sweet internet. But that's what they're doing anyway. Now, it's not their fault, really. If you hear anybody who tells you you shouldn't be an artist or you shouldn't attempt to be an artist, and then you don't attempt to be an artist because someone told you you shouldn't do it, then it's 100% your fault. You can't let anybody get in the way of you and God, the creative process, whatever you want to call it. This is why, though I don't consider myself a Christian, I really love the New Testament, because we have this weird, healing, magical, water-walking hippie wandering around telling everybody, you know, the guys who dress in the funny outfits and say they have a direct connection to God, you don't have to listen to them anymore. You can have a one-on-one direct conversation with the universe whenever you want to, wherever you happen to be, whatever you happen to be doing. Even if you're in the midst of a six-hour porn binge surrounded by a cluster of semen-encrusted Kleenexes that radiate out from your office chair like some kind of terrible genetic doom flower, even if you have just gone through a six-hour porn binge and heroin needles are hanging out of your arm like an opiated porcupine, even if you have just gotten off the phone with your mom in the midst of a six-hour porn binge after blasting your veins full of heroin and called her a cunt and then came into a Kleenex that you tossed down next to your chair and are now smoking a cigarette and watching more porn, you can still connect with that never-ending outflow of creativity that a lot of people lazily call God. That's my belief, and you should test it out. The main thing is, be a little scientist about all this stuff. Try it out. The point is, don't let any of these hex-casting curse-mongers trick you into thinking that for whatever reason, you aren't allowed, you aren't capable, you don't have the ability to produce some kind of art in this world. Is the art going to be great? Is it going to get hung in a museum? Is your podcast going to get a million downloads? Is President Barack Obama going to come over to your house and have a conversation with you because you're so good at interviewing? Who knows? Maybe not. But that's not the point. When you get caught up in the outcomes, when you get caught up in the results, when you get caught up in the fruits of your action, then you don't get to enjoy the initial paycheck that comes from the incredible harmonization that you can experience with everything that is. What that harmonization is, there's a lot of different words. Some people call it inspiration. Some people call it epiphany. Some people call it enlightenment. But whatever it is, it feels fucking great. I don't care if it's just that when you finish a podcast or a painting or a book, or you finish writing a story, or you finish anything, anything, even if you finish a Snapchat, if you finish a 15-second Instagram video, whatever it is, your synaptic vesicles release some of that sweet, good old-fashioned happy juice that we call dopamine, and for a little while, you're going to feel okay. You're going to get high on the amazing chemicals that exist in the celestial pharmacy that exists in your brain. And you know me, I love getting high, and there isn't a more pure drug than that which your mind creates. All the other stuff, as great as it may be, the sweetest, freshly baked, I don't think you bake LSD, but the Swedish LSD, the sweetest Swedish LSD cannot compare to the incredible, glorious, psychotropic chemicals that your mind creates on its own. And your mind is a really interesting drug dealer, because the way it dispenses drugs is by getting you to do healthy things, generally. You know, most drug dealers, when you go over there, they're not going to ask you to do push-ups, run 5 miles, write an essay on what love is, or a short story, or a painting, or a podcast. They're just going to ask for money. But the drug dealer that exists in your brain, he's a creative fella, and he requests really interesting forms of payment. From running 5 miles to forgiving someone that you haven't forgiven in a while, to paying bills that you've been putting off. These are the fees that are charged by this eccentric pharmacist who lives in your brain cave. Now, back in the old days when the Reagan pigs had clamped down on all forms of drugs and had shoved all forms of drugs from cannabis to mushrooms to LSD to heroin to crack cocaine into one category. Back in the old days, even though it's still happening a little bit, but at least it's not happening in Los Angeles. Back in the old days, you would go through things called a marijuana drought. I don't know if you guys are still experiencing that. If you live in California, if you're in Denver, you will never experience that again. But in the old days, back in Hendersonville, North Carolina, if you wanted marijuana, sometimes it would just dry up. People would get busted. There would be big old marijuana busts. You'd hear about them on the news, and you'd know that, well, weed's going to dry up for a little while. It's just gone. All your dealers, they just don't have any. And if they do have any, they're charging way too much money for it, based on the laws of supply and demand. It sucked. And so you'd go into these like terrible marijuana droughts, and it was just a mess. It was a real bummer, especially if it happened during the summer when you were just trying to enjoy camping and swimming in the rivers and lakes of North Carolina, or if you worked at a summer camp or whatever. It was just a real bummer, right? It sucked. So in the same way, if you're somebody who's going through some rough times, maybe a depression or just a general sense of bland boringness, that kind of strange calamity that can unexpectedly fall upon a human being on this planet, where the flowers don't seem as bright anymore, you don't feel as connected to nature, you feel a little distracted, you're a little blurry, you're on your phone too much, you're scanning bits of information like some scrounging, starving squirrel in some icy tundra looking for a nut. You're not depressed, you're just bored. And maybe you're depressed, who knows? You know, a lot of times prolonged boredoms can lead to depression. But in my opinion, if you find yourself in that situation where day after day, your love turns gray, like the skin on a dying man's back, that's a Pink Floyd quote, then there may be a kind of neurological drought happening in your brain. It may be that the drug dealer in your brain, for whatever reason, has decided to dry up the supply of dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, whatever you believe your neurological god happens to be. And if that's the case, then you might want to take a look at your life and ask yourself if that pharmacist, that alchemist, that biological engineer existing in your brain is demanding some kind of payment that you haven't been offering. Have you been running? Have you been going out in the sun? Have you been creating anything at all? When was the last time you created something? When was the last time you sat down and did a drawing? When was the last time you went to an art supply store and bought a canvas and some paint and just attempted to paint? When was the last time you made some music? Man, we exist in the glory age of creating music. It's so easy and fun now. It's so easy and fun. And let's all simultaneously give the middle finger to those shitty, old, crusty, bitter bastards who are jealous because these days you don't have to go through the severe learning curve that you had to go through if you wanted to learn to play music. Thanks to incredible programs like Logic, thanks to amazing synthesizers, thanks to, and all of these things, by the way, you can get demos for free right now. Thanks to, and you could get a MIDI keyboard that will plug into your computer and have a really amazing synthesizer for less than like $90 if you go to Guitar Center or wherever. So my point is, we have access to all this technology that in some way overcomes a lot of the learning curves that people used to have to go through if they wanted to create art. And that means that at this very moment, there are a million different possible ways that you could create something, that you could create a miniature work of art. And it doesn't have to be something, the project doesn't have to take years. We're not even talking about months. We're talking hours. Just sit down for an hour, get a copy of GarageBand, get a copy of Logic, download a sample of Photoshop, or just get a piece of paper and a pen, or just get some paint, or just get something laying around the house and some tape. Make a little collage, anything at all. Just do it and you will experience an amazing high, a really incredible kind of psychedelic trip that comes not just from the completion of a project, but the weird vanishing of time that happens when you experience the strange magnetic suction of the thing that you're creating. You will feel a kind of, you'll feel yourself get pulled into something. You'll feel this thing coming through. You'll start doing stuff and you won't understand why. You'll watch yourself doing it and you won't understand why. You won't even know who you are at that time. You won't even be there more than likely. But what'll happen is you'll look up at the clock and an hour or two or three or six has passed. And here is this brand new thing that you've brought into the universe, a completely brand new thing. You, a spinneret, the end result of 13.7 billion years of universal organization, has continued its unfolding process in the form of some sketch, a podcast, a collage, a song, whatever it may be. And that is a fucking miracle, man. It's a miracle when you look at the sheer improbability, the sheer statistical improbability of you existing at all. And then consider that you, this thing that exists in this infinite universe, is actually creating stuff based on your subjective experience or based on some intuition that you don't even understand. That's a miracle. So any of these sons of bitches that are in your life, Father forgive them. They know not what they do, but you got to start ignoring them. The person who told you you're not an artist, the person who told you you're not a writer, the person who told you you couldn't be a comedian, the person who told you you couldn't be a podcaster, the person who told you you couldn't do this or that, you're using their dark voodoo as an excuse to avoid the feeling of placing your psychic tendrils on the infinite electric fence that is the creative flow of the universe. It's scary. You lose control. You know, when you grab an electric fence, you just lock down on it for a second. It grabs you, and hopefully someone will knock you off the fence. But in the same way, this strange conduit, the source of creativity, the source of great ideas, if you allow yourself to get close to it, you'll clamp down for a second, and something will come out of you. It might be something you've been trying to avoid, because many of us don't like vomiting. That's something that isn't fun. You lose control when you're puking. When it finally happens, you know, when you finally at 3 a.m. manage to stumble out of the bed after you had six vodkas that night, and You actually just lose control. You can't breathe anymore because a geyser of vile vodka puke mixed with the hot dog you had after you left the bar comes flying out of you in an awful rainbow of poison into the toilet. It's not the most exciting thing to experience, but creativity, art, if you want to call it that, the creative process, it's weirdly similar. Only in this case, the thing that you're vomiting up isn't some regurgitated vileness, but is actually something quite beautiful. Something that over time, if you keep doing it, can actually develop into something that can help other people, God forbid, or can just make people feel happy, or can inspire people. So there you go, friends. Spend this weekend. Go to a craft store. Write a letter. Make something. Create something. If you're experiencing a drought of those sweet, beautiful brain chemicals right now, do a little experiment. See if perhaps that drug dealer in your brain might give you a little bit of a supply in exchange for a nice work of art. What a sweet drug dealer. There aren't many out there like that. Usually they want your money, or they want your body, or they want something else stupid. But in this case, they want your art. It wants your art. It wants you to create. Give it a shot. I challenge you to do it. Today, my God, this podcast is really cool. It's got everything I love in a podcast. We've got ghosts, we've got talk of comedy, and we've got a cult and a serial killer. It's all in this podcast with the amazing Adam Egit. We're going to jump right into it. But this episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by the fancy lads and lasses over at Casper.com. If you go to Casper.com/Family Hour and use offer code Family Hour, you will get $50 towards a brand new mattress. And let me tell you need a new mattress. Here's an intro from Bill Bryson's A Brief History of Nearly Everything. If you have a pillow that's older than 6 years old, then 1/10 of that son of a bitch's body weight is dead skin cells and old, dead microscopic beings. So think about your mattress. Really consider the fact that that thing that you're laying on, that ain't a mattress. That's a swarm of bacteria. That's an ocean. That's something that makes a Euronymous Bosch painting look like a picture of a glass of ice cold lemonade. You are laying on death, friends. You're laying on the tentacles of Cthulhu itself. You're laying, you might as well take a potato sack and fill it with pages from the Necronomicon and try to have a nice sleep on that accursed thing. You want to know why the gargoyle's been coming to you in your dreams and puncturing your rectum with its iron fist? It's because you're laying on a nightmare, your old mattress. But all that can change thanks to the heroic glory of the men and women at Casper.com, who have saved us as a civilization from being dragged through a mattress warehouse by a maniac mattress salesman who will pull us through his maze of overpriced mattresses like a dog dragging an old dead cat through a forest of thorns. Sure, I can read the talking points, and I will, because I have to, contractually. An obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. Risk-free trial and return policy. Try sleeping on a Casper for 100 days with free delivery and painless returns. The mattresses are made in America. Praise Allah. $500 for a twin-size mattress, $950 for a king-size mattress. Comparing that to industry averages, that is an outstanding price point! I could read all that, and I just did. But here's the main point. I sleep on a Casper mattress. Every single night, I lay my freshly lotioned body covered in a mixture of rare lotions, whale excretions, a combination of several different burial style chemicals, and blue eye-bluing drops. I'm trying to turn my eyes blue, ear stretchers, my hair combed back and freshly greased down. My feet have been massaged by several masseuses, grapes on my nipples, and a crucifix necklace draped around my neck. And when I lay down, I am laying on a Casper king-sized mattress. I sleep on one of these things. I went from a queen to a king. That's been the only change, because my bed is transformed into a kind of Noah's Ark covered with cats and dogs and a girlfriend, and so I needed a bigger bed. But I sleep on a Casper mattress, so I can't think of any better way to help you understand that these are great mattresses. Look, if you want to go to a mattress store and pay $16 million for some kind of rare mattress made from non-radioactive plutonium ore and the bottled farts of harem concubines in some distant palace in the Middle East, be my guest, friend. But if you don't feel like going through the hellstorm of a mattress store, and you don't feel like destroying your finances and the finances of every one of your ancestors for the next 1,000 years, then go to Casper.com/FamilyHour. Use offer code FamilyHour. You'll get $50 off a brand new mattress. And if you don't like it, if it chafes your nipples, if something about it makes you feel bad about life in general, or your dog growls at it for some reason, whatever, then you got 100 days, and you can send the son of a bitch back and get any kind of mattress that you please, because this is America, and you are an autonomous being constantly defining itself in every single moment. Casper.com/FamilyHour. Use offer code FamilyHour and get yourself a brand new mattress. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. There's no reason for you to go out anymore. You know, recently I went to the Glendale Galleria because I wanted to buy a new shirt, and it really was brutal. It was brutal on every level. It was just sick. Something about it's sick. I don't want to go to Tivana. I went into the Apple store for no reason, and just like a creep drew on the iPad in there, and then I kind of shuffled in to Bloomingdale's and bought a $70 shirt and just left feeling confused and sad. And that's what happens when you go to a place that's collecting the consumeristic farts of thousands of people all day long. Your brain doesn't understand it. It knows that not far from wherever you may be is some radiant, glowing bit of nature, whether it's a community garden or a forest, and it just can't understand why you would spend any amount of time in the artificially lit environment of a mall or a chain store. You can get almost anything that you need just by going to Amazon.com. And if you go through our portal located at DuncanTrussell.com, a very small percentage of whatever you buy will go to us, and it costs you nothing. So it's a great way for you to support this podcast while supporting your life. They got it all, friends. Rags to mop up your cat's diarrhea, bow ties, necklaces, earrings, archery equipment. I continue to use my Hoyt bow for target practice. I love shooting arrows. If you want to get something cool, go get that. Or if you really want to expand your consciousness and have the bottom drop out of the tiny constricted planet that you think that you're living on, then order a copy of Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything. But whatever it is that you're going to order on Amazon, go through our portal and bookmark it, won't you? It's a great way to support this show. A big thanks to all of you who continue to donate to this podcast. If you want to go crazy, you can actually do a monthly donation thing through PayPal. I'm not really sure how you do it, but I know people have spontaneously started doing that, and I'm very grateful to you all for doing that. Completely not necessary, but if you decide to do it, I will be very thankful, but I'm not asking for it. You don't have to do anything. Really, all I care about is that you listen to this show, and that makes me feel really good. It gives me a purpose in life, and it makes me feel like truly I must exist in some kind of Garden of Eden slash heaven slash God realm, and that's all because of you guys. Finally, and this is maybe the biggest announcement of them all, and I have to keep making this announcement on every single podcast, I am going on tour. And very quickly, I'm going to read all of the dates that I'm going to. Asheville, That starts on March 30th, then from there to Charleston, Durham, Richmond, Baltimore, Washington, D.C. on April 5th. I don't know what's going on with Washington. Guys, get these tickets in advance. I'm starting to feel like Washington doesn't like me. All the other shows are doing great. Let's get some tickets at Washington, friends. What have I done? This our nation's capital, the home of the Illuminati. It's right there. I don't know what I did to offend you guys, but if you're in Washington, D.C., come to the Howard Theater on April 5th and get tickets in advance, won't you? Philadelphia, Hamden, Boston, New York, Brooklyn, Pittsburgh, Columbus, Cleveland, Ferndale, Toronto, Chicago, Madison, Minneapolis, Kansas City, St. Louis, Nashville, Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, and back in Los Angeles. And then finally, the whole thing ends with a wonderful week in Maui. Oh, wow. That's going to be a great week where I'm going to be doing podcasts at the spring retreat with my teacher, Ram Dass, and Lama Surya Dass, and a lot of other incredible people. I hope you guys will come to these shows. Please don't put off buying tickets. I know you probably hear this a lot when comedians are shilling their shows, but tickets are going really fast right now for these shows. And if you buy them in advance, it assures that you'll be able to get in, and that's what we all want. Also, it gives me a glowing feeling of warmth and security to watch the tickets sell. That makes me feel good. So don't put it off. I'm a hypocrite for telling you to not put it off, because I put everything off. I buy my plane ticket to the last minute. I buy every ticket to the last minute. And if a show sells out, I'm usually like, whatever, I get to stay home and play Far Cry. I don't really care. So I understand, but if you feel it in your heart, go on the internet right now. If you're nearby, you're thinking about coming to these shows, and get the tickets in advance. Okay, my dear, darling, sweet friends. Today's guest is a really cool guy who happens to have the job that I used to have at the world famous Comedy Store in Los Angeles. So I used to be the talent coordinator of the Comedy Store, and this is a job that is a pretty high pressure, crazy job. And you're basically in charge of what comedians get to perform every single night. And when I was the talent coordinator, I was basically Mitzi Shore, the owner of the Comedy Store's assistant. So I didn't have any real power, thank God, which meant that if comedians weren't getting spots, they couldn't get angry at me about it, because it was all because of Mitzi. But Adam, he's the one actually doing these lineups, and it's an insane job. It's a combination camp counselor, tyrant, benevolent dictator, euthanizer, mystic, shaman. It's the job requires so many weird skills, and Adam is just doing an incredible job of it. If you haven't been to the Comedy Store lately, definitely stop by. Something is reactivated in that place, and it's sold out almost every night. The energy there is just incredible, dark, powerful, vibrant, and I think a lot of it is because of the energy that Adam has been pouring into that club. Also, Adam has had a very interesting past, including getting sucked into a cult. And so we talk about that in this podcast. We talk about ghosts. We talk about the Comedy Store. And I got to tell you, I really, this is one of my favorite episodes that I've ever done. So now, everybody, please, open your hearts. Send out as much love, happiness, joy, any kind of sweetness that you can send in the direction of today's guest, who is truly doing the Lord's work at the Comedy Store in West Hollywood. Everybody, please welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, Adam Egit. Adam.
Jack.
Awesome. Hey, man, welcome to the podcast.
Dude, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming up here.
Absolutely.
You know, I guess the best way to start is to talk about this job that you have.
Right.
That I used to have.
Yes, you did.
You are the talent coordinator of the Comedy Store.
Right.
And can you describe for people who maybe aren't aware of what the Comedy Store is, can you describe it to people? Like, how would you describe
it? Well, I mean, it was always described to me as an artist colony. And I think that's a pretty accurate depiction. I think that it's probably evolved a little bit. I think it's become more... It's changed. It's evolved, certainly. But I think at its core, I think it's still just this artist colony where comics come and feel safe to hang out and perform and work out new material. It's like a gym. It's like a gym, right?
Yeah, it's a combination.
More than any other comedy club.
Gym, mental asylum, energy vortex.
It is an energy vortex.
Yeah.
There's a dark... I don't want to scare... There really is. Like, I'm not... I was always incredibly skeptical, but since work... You know, I've only been there for about 5 years now, but I feel it. And over time, like, it's not something that I felt instantly, but over time, it just sort... Like, it's clear. It's pretty clear to me. There's something there.
I think when people think about a comedy club, when they think about most comedy clubs, their idea is a kind of sanitized... place, yeah. You know, in general, unless like you live in Denver and have been to the Comedy Works, or there's a few that have real character, but mostly you just think of a kind of sanitized place. You go in, sit down, have a dinner.
Yep.
Some people will do stand up and then that's it. And you leave if you're an audience member. But the Comedy Store is this haven for comedians, many of them who have been there for decades now, for decades.
Argus celebrated his 40th anniversary last night.
40th anniversary. So this is a life for people there. Yeah. And I can remember, so when I was working for Mitzi as a talent coordinator, somebody called in their avails, and I guess I didn't write them down or something, and I wasn't thinking it was that big a deal. And she's like, "This is their life, honey."
It's so true.
Because,
when they stop getting spots or they get less, it's almost I've never seen anything like it.
How many spots are there per week that you have at the Comedy Store? God.
I mean, I've added a few shows. I'd say what? So you got 15 spots a night in the OR. So that's 6 nights a week.
So we got 90 spots.
90 plus, and then you got the two main room shows. So that's another 20 because you only have about 10 on those.
Okay.
And then I added, so what is that? That's 110. Plus maybe I added an early Saturday show, which gave me another 10.
Okay. So we have about 120 spots, give or take a few spots.
Yeah, for the week.
To give to comedians.
Yes.
And how many comedians want spots?
Oh, pages. So I got scores. I mean... You've seen the name. Anybody that's been to the Comedy Store sees those names on the wall. And I'd say, you know, I don't have Ace Trucking Company calling in for spots, but a good percentage of those names that are on the wall still call in every week,
right?
Even if they don't get spots. Because I tell people, I tell people that to keep calling in because you never know if there's a bunch of people that are going to be out of town 1 week and I may need someone, but it doesn't happen.
Because no matter what, you're going to have this hierarchy of talent. Calling in, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to have people like Bill Burr. You're going to have people like Rogan. You're going to have these like Louis C.K.
Yeah.
Legendary comedians.
Absolutely.
Calling in. So you've got some percentage of those spots has to go to those people.
Yeah, any spot they're calling for, they get.
You're running a business. So and when the audience comes, if you were to like do a vote for like, who would you like to see perform? Bill Burr or this guy who's like working on material on his new hour that you've probably never seen before.
Right.
They're going to say Bill Burr.
Of course.
100% of the time. But the challenge of the job is that you don't want it to just be a showcase club for famous comedians.
No.
Because the heart and soul of the thing is that people come through there, figure this craft or art out, and then go on to, you're growing. It's like a, what do you call it? It's like a greenhouse. So you're growing comedians too.
Exactly. And I think that I try and maintain, I remember Argus used to tell me that Argus Hamilton, who we were just talking about, been there for 40 years. And he said that Mitzi looked at it like a canvas. And I don't want to sound pretentious. I just got thrown into the job. But I try to keep that in mind when I do the lineups. And so from 9:45 till about 10:30, I try and put those comics in that you just discussed
yes.
so eloquently is the people that the audience mostly wants to see
yeah.
and the big draws. And then I put the people that are up and come, that are like right on the cusp, that are about to, I think are the best I have that aren't household names yet,
yeah.
but will soon be probably household names. Then I put the dark, like the people that deserve their shot at a chance to develop, much like the comics who came before them had a chance to develop, who have only been passed in the last year or two.
Yeah.
And then that kills everyone. Like, so all those people that were getting spots before, I brought Rogan, you know, Rogan was awesome enough to come back to the store. It's so great to have him and Diaz back. And then I brought in, you know, all these other comics like Anthony Jeselnik and Louis when he's in town, and Rock when he's in town,
yeah.
and then Bill Burr, and brought in Greg Fitzsimmons and Nikki Glaser and all these people. So that killed a lot of spots, man.
Right.
And it's, you know what it was like. I mean, I think that we obviously have incredibly different experiences in the same position, but I think that you've more than anyone I know, you've been invaluable to talk to about this.
We're talking about a dog with 120 nipples, basically.
That's exactly
right. A dog with 120 nipples. And we're talking about these beings who depend on the sustenance from those nipples for a lot of different things,
yeah.
to develop their material, for just a sense of gratification, just a feeling like, okay, I must be doing all right, I'm getting spots, to just a feeling of like accomplishment. And so and comedians are, everyone knows that when you describe a comedian, it's very rare that you hear, oh yes, it's a very level-headed, emotionally stable person. Like, comedians yeah. are like, comedians have, the reason they're so funny is because many of them have very difficult childhoods. Many of them have a lot of stuff going on, and they're using comedy as a way to survive, basically.
Yeah.
It's keeping them, it's all that they've got, and it's all that they want, and it's the only thing they could do. So I'm building it up maybe a little more dramatically than it is.
No, I think that's true.
Pretty
though.
Close.
Yeah.
So this creates, as the talent coordinator, you find yourself, and fortunately for me, when I was the talent coordinator, it was Mitzi was the one doing the spots.
Right.
But you find yourself, this is not a normal job.
No.
You find yourself as a kind of either benevolent or tyrannical dictator running a tiny little island. And this island is filled with some of the most intelligent, manipulative, chaotic people on planet Earth.
Yeah.
So it is a fascinating job. And I don't think a lot of people understand the amount of psychic abuse and torture and mind-numbing guilt that can come in this job, because people will come to you and you have legitimately, even though you didn't intend to do it, you have legitimately fucked up their lives.
Yeah.
And it's not your fault.
No, I know. Right. I don't sleep much anymore. I really don't. it's funny, cause I used to have different reasons for not, for having restless nights. And now it's become all about the store and these lives that you just discussed. It's difficult. It kills me a little inside every time I have to tell someone I don't have spots for them.
Yeah.
And, I know how important it is to these people. And, it's just, I have to do what I feels right. Like, and it's nothing personal, but, it always feels that way, at least on their end. I understand that.
Are you grinding your teeth yet?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's the, so you start like grinding your teeth, you start like having these just like, you get embroiled. And I don't know if people understand the dramas that, well, these storm systems will erupt in this place. Like, yeah. I could tell you there's sagas that happen there.
I'm already a part of them. It's like a soap opera mixed with the Overlook Hotel. I look at it like my Overlook Hotel. It really
hilarious.
Is like the Overlook Hotel,
yeah,
and I feel like Jack Torrance. I really do.
It is.
Like, I'm losing my mind there, and I feel like we've always been there. Like, you look at these pictures on the wall of
yeah.
all the ghosts and all the people from the past, and it just really does. And there's a dark energy. It's
yeah.
like there's It really does. The main room reminds me of the Gold Ballroom. It's just
the dress, the green room and the main room. Come on,
there's just all the history there.
It's the heart of the building, right there.
I know.
It's the, what is it called? The Lodge in Twin Peaks.
Oh my God! I just rewatched it. I watched the last episode this morning at 3 a.m. That's so weird. It is. It's the Black Lodge.
It's the Black Lodge, and so much has gone on there. You know, people have died. You know, this is a famous story. That's what the new Showtime series is based on. The book "I'm Dying Up Here," which is about a Comedy Store comedian who jumped from the roof of the Hyatt next door to the Comedy Store with a sign around his neck saying,
"I am Steve Lubeckin. I used to work at the Comedy Store. I used to be a comic.
I used to be a paid regular, or something like that." But so that's how serious this place is, and that's how serious this bizarre little ecosystem is.
Yeah.
And the difficulty, I think, in your position as a talent coordinator, as opposed to when I had the job, is you have no shield.
Exactly. And I think so with Mitzi's era,
It was an era.
You had Johnny, it literally would make someone's career a spot, because you had the Carson bookers who would be in the crowd, and would just watch there. They'd watch religiously every night, and it was just when Johnny Carson's show moved from New York to L.A., and that created this boom which inevitably created the Improv and the Comedy Store, because all these stand up comedians started going up at the Store and the Improv, and then someone from the Carson show would see them and put them up the next day, and it would virtually make a career.
That's right,
Freddie Prinze and all these people, and then it's something changed, you know, over time that I think now we're in a place where it just doesn't work that way anymore, obviously, where the Carson show, it just doesn't exist, that format.
No, that's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. But still, there's so many comics right now. It's so popular. I can't even fathom. It just seems like there's so many, and there's so few spots available.
Yeah.
And it's true that I don't have Mitzi as a shield, but I don't know. I think there's pros and cons to both, where you could deflect it to Mitzi. But I'm not – there's other stuff involved. I'm just – it's not my club, so
– right.
I have bosses to answer to, but unfortunately I have to fulfill all of these obligations and these wishes and other requests from my employers, and we have to make sure that we're making money and the club is full, and then I don't know, it's hard to explain, but unfortunately I have to put it all on myself. I can't say, oh, so and so told me I have to put this person up. You know what I mean?
But since your reign started, you followed the reign of Tommy. And since your reign started, the place has flourished. The club is booming. It's never, when I was there, it certainly wasn't like that. When I was there, this was this is the, there's really interesting. And guys, I know this probably, if you haven't been at the Comedy Store, but just trust me when I tell you, everything we're saying, we're barely inflating it. Really is like that. But an Arthurian legend, if you've ever watched Excalibur,
sure,
they say, when the king is sick, the land is sick, right?
Exactly.
So the spirit of the ruler is reflected in the land. And when I was there, Mitzi was going, it was a rough spot for her, man. And she had a lot of concerns. I think most of her life had spent, the main concern is just developing comedians. Everything was about the Comedy Store. She treated that place with the exact same level of discipline and energy that whenever you hear about the great, great people like Einstein, or whenever you hear about the greatest of the greats, it's always amazing how they're inexhaustible. The moment they wake up to the moment they go to bed, they 100% are focused on this one thing. And that's what Mitzi was like. But then Mitzi, we all have a human body, and the human body gets old. And so she started having these other concerns. And so the place, it kind of started getting wonky, it was wobbly and out of and it certainly wasn't profitable at that time. And then,
and I think her lineups reflected the state of mind that she was in, she wasn't. Yeah. I mean, you were there. I wasn't there at that time.
Well, it was,
all these comics that weren't really relevant anymore and weren't.
the doors were pretty sealed pretty tight.
Right.
So what was happening is there wasn't an influx of a lot of like what you're seeing right now, which is like, you know, it felt like it was kind of like a skipping record a little bit, right? It just felt a little like it just wasn't moving forward. It was
like a wax museum like a tomb almost.
That's right. It just didn't have the because I remember when I first came to the Comedy Store as a phone guy, there's a comedian named Russell who was telling me what it was like in the 80s. You know, because he'd been there, and he's like, "You don't understand, man. There were lines out the door. It was packed. It was always packed. The energy was incredible. You just don't know, man. It was just the most amazing place. Everywhere you looked, there was another famous comedian. It was just insane, right?
Right.
And I remember him describing that to me, and just thinking, "Well, it ain't that now, man. It's definitely not that now."
It evolved into Wonka, where it was like, "No one ever goes in.
That
no one
it.
Ever goes out."
That's what. Yeah. It, that's exactly it.
Right. Right.
That's it.
And she was Willy Wonka.
Yeah, man. Yeah. That's it. That's totally it. The gates were shut. So then I left. Tommy took my place. And then Tommy got a little more responsibility, I guess. And you know, there's no point in going into that story.
Right.
But then, and then you came. And all of a sudden, just everything just blew up in the place. And like now when I go there, it's like, holy shit. This is what Russell was talking about. Like, this thing is flowering now that had not flowered in years, and it's really an intense thing to witness, man.
It's a palpable energy. Like, it's tangible. Like, you can feel it. Last night, Seinfeld came in and performed. He hasn't been on stage in that room since 1979.
Holy shit.
That was the last time he was there.
Shit.
He told a great story about how Mitzi never liked him,
never
passed him.
Yeah, that's right.
Actually, he told this great story about how after he found all his success, like he just got the show, it was a huge hit, and he kept calling in for spots, and Mitzi goes, "Yeah, I know you're real successful. I just don't like you."
Yeah.
She literally just told him, she said that basically he's going to need someone to keep him grounded. And
part of her. I think that was part of her technique, man. Like, because she was
an icon.
Icon, and she really was developing comedians.
Yeah.
And when you hear that, and you think, oh, well, then
what am I going to do with him?
What are you doing?
No, yeah, that's probably what you like. What am I going to do with him? He's already developed or whatever. Like when these people
I think
come
she
back.
Still was trying to develop. I think that she. So when we think about like comedy is stand up is a craft that you learn from failure. You learn from rejection.
Absolutely.
And you learn from bombing. And
yeah.
You learn from what doesn't work. And you learn whether or not, you know, if it doesn't work, is it because that joke sucks? Or is it because it's not the right room for it?
Right.
So there's all these things you learn. But it's an art of pain, right?
Yes.
So if someone was...
great art comes from great pain. All
that's
great
right.
art. Absolutely.
And if Mitzi is the patron of that art form... then she must therefore induce pain as part of her process in teaching people.
She's, the George Martin, God rest in peace, of stand-up comedy.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's
sure.
it. And putting that, so when like someone, and that was what was, you know, that was the, what was great about her process and also her Achilles heel is that she, of all the people in the world, she of course would be the one who tells fucking Seinfeld, "No, honey. You're gonna have
I respect that so much.
I do too.
I love it. I love her for it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think about that and I just and I love what you said about the pain and not and how the importance of bombing and failure. All the importance of failure makes me think of the I stayed at Ari's place in New York one time, Ari Shaffir, and he had this great this huge like calendar. It was just a chart, I guess, where it had a hundred. You've seen that? 100 dates and an X through each date.
Yeah.
And on the top, I think it was Bobby Lee. I don't know. He must have heard it from Bobby, I think. And it said, you're never going to be.
You have to bomb 100
times
to be a great comic. So there's 100 squares on this son of a bitch.
For every time that fucking guy bombed.
He wrote a date in.
Yeah.
What a brilliant son of a bitch.
I love him so much.
I do too, man.
Yeah,
how
so
cool
happy
is that?
For him.
That is so cool. Yeah. And you, so this place, the way she did it, and it wasn't just pain. The other thing about Mitzi that was so incredible and that kind of elevated her to like a cult-like status is that not only was she a master at dispensing pain in the sense of, in the form of true rejection. Like, because mm-hmm. It's like putting animals to sleep. Like, she would make the decision that this comic or that comic couldn't come to the store anymore. These were the bans. She called it banning comedians. But so I would have to get on the phone and tell a comedian, I'm really sorry. She says she wants you to work out at other clubs for a little while. And it was those are the most brutal phone calls to make.
It's like firing.
It sucks. It's worse than firing
way
someone.
Worse, way because worse. It's like, yeah.
You're taking away a canvas from someone who like is depending on that canvas. But again, it's there. You have to understand right. The comedy club isn't the only club to work at. And if you've gotten it in your head that or the comedy store isn't the only club. So, but outside of that aspect of her, the other aspect of her, I have never seen anybody who loves comedians more than that woman. So when she wasn't like inflicting you by putting you on stage for 4 weeks straight following someone you just broke up with because she didn't like comedians to date. So like if the moment like comedians broke up, you could be certain one would follow the other on the lineup because she thought it was so fucking funny.
I've heard so many stories like that.
So funny.
A big fight and then one's bringing up the other next
That's
week.
That's right.
You can bet on that.
You can bet on it for sure. Yeah. For sure. Because she thought it was funny. And also she's teaching these incredible lessons, right?
Yeah.
She's teaching that like your art has to transcend your social life. You have to be able to like handle any situation. So there was this other thing this thing inside of her that's just like the most amazing love. And we don't have to keep going on about the comedy store because there's some other stuff I want to talk about with
yeah,
you,
sure.
But the I remember like one of my favorite stories about her is we're sitting down by the bar because that's where she'd do business. Mm-hmm. And one thing she'd do, I'll just tell two quick stories about her, Matt. One thing that she'd do is pretend to be feeble if she was in a business meeting, right? So I remember like someone would come with some idea, something they wanted to do. Everyone had these things they wanted to do there.
Right.
And like I'd be sitting with her, and right before the person came, she's like just sharp and focused and completely there at the level of like some like you're with a president or something, you know, like just a mogul or something, just completely there. Okay, what's going on today? All right, well, okay. Who is this son of a bitch? All right, well, then they come in and you watch her just kind of shrink down. Suddenly she's not this like dragon being. She's just this kind of old lady who's like maybe not all there. And then,
oh my God.
And then from that, the person would start treating her differently, you know? So the way that they would, because she seems so vulnerable. So they'd start revealing what they're like. I swear I saw it.
That's amazing.
Then they'd leave and she'd be like right back. She's like, fuck that guy. It was awesome to watch. Brilliant, man. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. But the other thing, because we always had these meetings at that bar, man. The other thing, I'll never forget, this kid comes in, just coming to town from Florida, mm-hmm. wanted to be a comedian, you know, walks right up to us sitting there. And that look, man, she had the side eye, man. She had the most amazing, like she looks up at him and he's like, I came from Florida. I want to be a comedian. I just want to work out here. And, you know, you're like, oh shit, what's gonna happen?
Right.
You know, this could go either way. and like you just see her like light up. All of this love comes pouring out of her, and she's like, oh great, honey. Oh, that's good. You will start working out on Sundays on the open mic. And it was the sweetest thing.
Wow.
That first time.
Wow.
But then after that, torture, you know? But the first there's this welcoming sweetness followed by the screws being put in. And it creates some great comics, that technique,
yeah.
You know?
I mean, I don't want to go back to Ari, but really quick, Ari said he had a showcase for her 30-something times before she passed.
Them. Yeah, that's right.
It's wild.
Yeah.
She was so good at that. Yeah, the pain.
And I think she, in her mind, I think it's like if I'm going to make it so that unless you're a comedian, you're not going to keep doing this.
Right.
I'm going to save you from going down a path that maybe isn't your path by putting these ridiculous Shaolin monastery kung fu level challenges in front of you.
Right.
And if you really want to be a comedian, you're going to get through it.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to be a comedian, you're not. And you can blame it on me. You could say it's the comedy store's fault. You could blame it on whatever you want. But a real comedian is very similar to that fucking daisy you see growing up out of a sidewalk. It's going to grow no matter what. No matter what gets in its way, it's going to grow.
Absolutely. So even, like, even in the comedy store environment.
And I think that if there's any balm that you can have when you start feeling that guilt of telling people that you don't have spots for them right now, it's that if they're a comedian, they're going to keep doing comedy. And if they're a comedian, they're going to find places to go up. And if they're a comedian, they're going to keep developing. Yeah. And if they're a comedian, they're going to figure out a way to get those spots again at the comedy store.
Exactly.
And it's up to them. It's not you. It's not on you. It's not your fault. And I think that's one of the most important lessons in all art. Don't be a fucking victim. Don't be dependent on this place or that place or any place.
1,000%. You know, and I got to witness it firsthand, all of these comics who were so bitter and held it against Tommy, their misfortunes or their, you know, the success that they never achieved. They always held, most of them, I don't want to say all of them, but many of them held that against Tommy, and they held it so tightly. And I never understood that. And then I think once I took over, I think a lot of them realized this had nothing to do with Tommy. This is, I'm the only one should be held accountable for any success I achieve, and it's my, you know, it's up to me.
It's up to you.
Yeah,
it's up to you. It's up to everyone. You're not a victim. You can't be. And if you're if you especially when it comes to art victims. Come on, really?
Right.
Like this is your, like you're an art victim. That's ridiculous.
It's nonsense.
It's nonsense. And it's a, and putting yourself into that position as an art victim is really to, I think, negate the thing that's going to make you a really funny comic.
Absolutely.
Which is coming to terms with your failure, looking into your heart and witnessing where you're at.
Yeah, it's accountability.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's, if you want to make a change, it's got to come from with you. It's not with the regime change.
No.
Certainly not.
No.
That doesn't mean I still feel an incredible guilt.
You still are going to hurt from it, but as long as you, I just, anybody, not just in like when it comes to the comedy store, but anytime. Most, like, I know from personal experience, when I'm blaming someone else for my own failure, there I can always look into my heart and see every single time that I didn't do the thing I was supposed to do, all the little steps I took that led to the failure. And from that analysis, I usually am able to find the way out, because if you can find the way you got in, you can always find the way out. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, but if you don't, if you think you are sort of like hoodwinked or tricked or the world's against you, then how do you get out of that mess? Now
exactly.
You're just in an endless prison of victimhood.
Why hold on so tightly? It's gonna you're gonna remain stagnant. You're not gonna move forward. You're just holding on tightly, like Gollum clutching this ring.
Yeah.
Of bitterness and anger, and it's all misguided. There's one quick little anecdote that I always loved about Mitzi that I heard recently. Mitzi and Tommy, the old talent coordinator, were sitting in the main room one day, and she turns to Tommy and she said, "Tommy, I swear I think their comics are living in here." And she goes, "No." And he goes, "No, Mitzi, I don't think that's true. That's not true." And then at that exact moment, this comic who didn't get many spots comes waltzing out of the main room green room in a towel, drying his hair off with another towel. "Hey, Mitzi." And she just looked at she just gave that side look that you were describing to Tommy. I love that story.
The funniest shit would happen around her, man. Like stuff that would happen around her that was so perfectly timed and insanely funny. And her reaction to it was like, man, it sounds so weird, but she was so connected to that building, man, that her reaction to it was like, sometimes she felt like she was the building, like
that's
turned
so
into
crazy.
A person. It's really weird, man. A lot of metaphysical stuff goes on there. I'm not ashamed to believe in it. I know it's there. I've seen it. It's incredible.
I was a skeptic for a long time, and then when I started closing up every night during the witching hour at 3 o'clock, I never saw anything, but man, I certainly felt shit.
Did I tell you my ghost experience there?
No.
Man, I had a couple. One of them, one of them was just like crazy, which was Mitzi was pissed at me. This is before Carlos Mencia's like fall from grace. So he's like a big deal. And he wanted to come perform at the store. He was coming. And, man, I just forgot to put his name on the sign, man. It's just a big fuck-up, though, you know, because that's going to bring some people in. And but for Mitch, like, a thing like that now, you know, it's like, all right, whatever, man. Just, like, get it together. Put his name on the sign. Put it up now.
Yeah.
But for Mitzi, oh, man, that's no – you forgot to put the headline, this big headliner's name on the sign of the building. We're not getting, like, big numbers right now. What are you doing, man? That's a real fuck-up. So, like, I remember she's just like – she comes in, she walks up to me, and she's just like, basically, I can't remember what she said exactly. She's like, fuck you, Duncan. And your heart shrivels in your chest. You could feel your heart withering. You could feel just the petals of your heart folding inward. You just want to vanish into a black hole to escape the wrath of Mitzi. There's nothing like it I've ever experienced. So she's like, go up to your fucking office. She wanted me to get something in the office. So like I go running up to the office. I'm just like, well, I'm definitely getting fired. There's no question about it. I'm done here. And I got up to the office, and you know, to get up to the talent office, or I don't know, where do you work now?
No, I think it's in the same one. It's not all the way at the top where Paulie's office.
That used to be the talent coordinator's
office. That used to be it.
So Paulie's office used to be the talent coordinator's office. That's where at the time, this is before Paulie moved in there. So I go through, you unlock like you have to unlock two doors to get there.
Right. So, it's where the roof. So you were inside where the roof access was, or were you on the other side where the bigger space is?
That bigger space. Got it.
Okay.
So a lot of like doors you have to unlock to get there, and a lot of lights you have to turn on.
Sure. Still.
So I run into my office and I'm grabbing whatever the thing is you wanted. I don't even remember what it was. But from the other, there's an office right next to that. Something just starts pounding on the fucking wall, man. Like the.
What time was this during the
this is during the show
evening?
This is during the show. It's 9 o'clock. Yeah.
Okay.
But no one could I was the one who unlocked the doors, unless someone was like secretly hiding after the doors had been locked, which is equally creepy.
Right.
But someone's like the wall is, you could see the wall shaking.
Holy
I don't know
shit.
What the fuck that was, but I was so terrified of Mitzi that it was less frightening than what was happening to me. I'm just like, oh great, this is when the ghost happens. I didn't look in the office to see what it was. I just ran downstairs. So I don't know what that was. Probably a comic tricking me. Who knows? But the other one, man. Hallway of the belly room. So for you guys who
that's where I always hear stories about.
That's where it's at.
That hallway.
For you guys who haven't been to the Comedy Store, there's an upstairs room called the belly room. It's like a 90-seater. Wonderful, wonderful, cool room. But there's a hallway that leads from the green room to the belly room.
Right.
So,
do you want to give a backstory on that room itself?
You give the backstory.
Well, I can't verify. I've always been enamored by that story, but I've never been able to verify if it's true.
The abortion story?
Yeah.
So supposedly backroom abortions were given
yeah.
up there. Which
botched abortions.
That's the ironic
belly. Yeah.
Belly room. Yeah, that's belly why room. It being called the belly room, even though
I think it was about belly last, but I wouldn't put it past Mitzi to have some sort of double entendre with that.
Well,
And the one thing about Mitzi is she was always big on, she didn't want to change a thing about that building. You always see, you know, I hear all these stories from different parts of the building, because when Mitzi bought the property, they would say, oh, you know, this is from Sierra's. And it was, there was a lot of mob connection to it.
Oh,
apparently,
yes.
Mickey Cohen and, I was told that she didn't want to change a lot. So there's, I don't know. So that would
make sense.
Supposedly
there's bodies in the walls.
Yeah.
But she, she would like paint, there's a fire hydrant in front of the club,
mm-hmm.
and she would always have, does Juan Carlos still work there?
Yeah, absolutely.
So she would have Juan Carlos paint it silver in front of the club. So he'd go and paint he would paint the fire hydrant silver, and then there was this endless war between her and the fire department, who would come out and paint it yellow again.
How is she not? Did she get fined? How is that?
No,
like,
she wouldn't. Nothing.
She's above the law.
She's above the law.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
They probably thought it was funny, I guess, but nothing ever happened. But that was a thing. Oh, paint the hydrant, Juan Carlos. Yeah, so the other ghost experience was
hallway
to
the
belly room. I'm sitting in the green room waiting to go up, because that's when I first started working out there. She started giving me spots in the belly room on Fridays, and that's where I got to learn. That's where I got to have a regular place to try out stand up for years. So I'm sitting there looking down the hallway, and these two people are in a fight, right? And they're like, I don't know what they're in a fight over, but they're gesticulating. And, you know, it's a really passionate fight in this standing in the hallway. So they stop fighting and walk away. And I'm just sitting there. And then I look up. Two completely different people are standing in the exact spot in the same fucking fight, man. The same kind of hand gestures, the same motion. And that, to me, was the ghost, which is like there was something there, like some kind of energy
like
vortex.
Like an imprint.
An imprint.
Something that just occurred. That's what I love that theory about when people explain ghosts as just, well, if it does exist, it has to be just energy.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's fascinating. I've heard stories about that hallway, about an orb where they see not an orb, like a this just like a fog, like an almost like this. They call her the white lady or something. I don't know what the fuck they have
something's
a name
in
for.
There.
But that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's crazy, and like when you're working there at night, my God, locking
worst.
Up. No,
I hated
thanks.
That. I hated that.
No, thanks. You've been there for 5 years.
Yeah, five.
What were you doing before?
I used to manage the Improv in Arizona, in Tempe.
Okay.
And I was there for about 7 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I moved out. I'm from L.A. So I'm from the San Fernando Valley, and I was born in Santa Monica, raised in the Valley. Moved out to Arizona, stayed out. I was supposed to just be out there for a couple years, but ended up staying for about 10. And then moved back home. And then started working at the Comedy Store almost immediately. I heard they were looking for a manager. I didn't even apply. Someone just said, hey, someone's looking for a manager. And I went in and interviewed, and I got hired as an assistant manager.
And you've been in comedy then for basically your whole working life. Have you ever had
outside
of comedy?
Yeah, I used to be an assistant to Amy Heckerling, the director. I was her PA for like a year. Then I worked at E! Entertainment Television. I was always in the industry for the most part. Then I moved to Arizona and I just started bartending.
Did you ever entertain the idea of like doing stand-up?
I did stand-up for like 5 months.
Okay.
Just to see what it was like, just to like kind of face some fears. It's not, I have pretty bad stage fright. I would have to drink pretty heavily before I got on stage,
right,
which isn't great. It's
no.
not conducive to comedy.
It's not sustainable.
No,
it's not
it's
a good
certainly
long-term...
not sustainable. I tried to sustain it without comedy. It's not sustainable either way for me, but I just... I gave it a shot. It was fun. Highest highs, lowest lows. I know what it's like to try it, but no.
Not into
for
it.
Me. Not for me.
No no performance desire, no
not
like...
Not really. You know, I've done it. You know, I used to do this podcast with Norm MacDonald, he's still one of my favorite stand-up comics of all time. I think he's the funniest guy I've ever met. And I had so much fun doing that. I was a sidekick on there, and we would write these opening sketches together. It was really fun. I don't really have any desire to act or perform. David Spade just made, he made Joe Dirt 2 recently.
Yeah.
And he always gives me shit because my voice, I sound like Buffalo Bill.
Oh yeah.
So he had a part for this young Buffalo Bill. So he flew me out there and I did this part in Buffalo and Joe Dirt too. And it was so fun. It was a fun experience.
How fucking cool, man.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was so fun. But that was, yeah, it was just a fun experience. It was really cool. But I have it's not for me.
Now you grew up in LA.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this a little bit, but apparently you were a bit of a miscreant, huh? Is that the right word, miscreant? Is that even a word?
You would know better than I would.
I wanted to say cretin, but miscreant came out. I don't even think that's a word. Let me look it up. Miscreant. Oh, yeah, that's a word.
Of course
a person who behaves badly. Yeah, so you
were...
So
that would have made me.
Yeah, so you were...
A little cretin?
A cretin.
Yeah, there we go.
So when did that start? Like when did you start getting in trouble?
I started when my parents separated. So I was right after my bar mitzvah. I was probably about 14 when I started acting out a little bit. I would get in fights at school, and then I started. I was always kind of self destructive. I mean, I'm a huge Smiths fan, so I was a cutter.
Oh shit!
So I would cut on myself a lot, and then my parents sent me to a like a psych ward. I would get sent away there, and then
when was the first time you started cutting?
I think it was 13, almost 14.
Do you remember why you did it?
I think it was for attention, for sure. It had to be for attention.
It wasn't because of some people who cut, they just are numb. apparently. And
I felt numb, but I think maybe it started out that way, but then I realized all the attention I got from it, and I wasn't really getting much.
Okay.
I had gained a lot of weight. I was very depressed. I was being made fun of at school, and it was like an outlet for my, you know, pain and aggression, whatever. But then it turned into, I think it had to be mostly for attention.
So you were kind of like a goth, right? Like
I didn't dress goth. Maybe on the inside.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I was a goth on the inside.
You have brothers or sisters?
I have a younger sister and then a half brother and a half sister.
Okay. So your parents, your mom divorced.
Yeah, and my dad married someone else and had a couple kids later.
And you stayed with your mom or your dad?
I stayed with my mom mostly.
When was the divorce?
I was probably 14.
14, that's a rough one.
Yeah, it's a tough age, right?
Yeah.
And then I started cutting on my face, like on my cheeks and stuff. Eventually they told me, you know, if I did it again... And then I punch holes in walls. I was an angry kid. I didn't have any, yeah.
Because a divorce is like, it's not just like the divorce happens when you're 14. It's not like just right. Like your parents are getting along. And then there's this, oh, well, we're going to divorce.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot of lead up.
There's a lot of build up, yeah.
There's a lot of build up. And that build up is not pleasant. That's a turbulent thing because your parents, it's not working. And so here are these two people who are in this insanely stressful situation of having kids.
Yeah.
And they're not getting along anymore. And there's a lot of reasons. I don't know why with your parents.
Oh, yeah. Well, my dad, you know, I remember going to Betty Ford Center. So he had a lot of drug and alcohol problems. And then right. He got sober. And then as soon as he got sober, he left my mom.
Wow.
Yeah. But then I just kept fucking up. I just kept fucking up. And then they sent me away to this boarding school. They threatened it, but I didn't think it would ever happen. And it was just...
This boarding school, now, what's it called?
It's called CEDU.
How did they hear about it?
They heard about it through some counselors at the psych, at the Northridge psych ward, or whatever I don't even know what the fuck
it was. How long were you in the psych ward for?
Shit, I was there three times. The first time was probably for about a week. The second time was maybe 2 weeks. And then the third time was like a day or two before they took me out of there and sent me to this boarding school.
Did you like the psych ward?
No, it was horrible. I was roommates with this kid who claimed he was a gang member. I remember one day I woke up and we got into some altercation. It was like a one sided. I didn't even realize we were just sort of making fun of each other, but it started off playfully. And then I remember waking up and he had a belt around my fucking neck and he was just choking me.
Fuck.
It was insane.
You're in a psych ward.
Yeah, I know, right? I totally forgot I was in psych ward. But yeah, it was just fucking, I didn't belong there. I was just like white Jewish kid from the suburbs. And then I'm like rooming, my roomie is this guy, gang member, who said he killed people and shit. He had tats all over. He was 13-year-old with tats all over him.
Wow.
It's crazy. But then, yeah, so then they're like, hey, you fuck up again. We're not taking you to there. We're taking you to this boarding school. You're going to be there for a couple years.
And what does CEDU stand for?
It's so bizarre because it's not even, it's not. It's see yourself as you want to be and then do something about it.
Okay.
But it's not spelled seed. It's not spelled the way
C-do.
It should be then.
C-do.
Yeah. It's spelled CEDU.
See who you are. Yeah. See how you want to be and then do something about it.
Yeah.
So sounds kind of like tough love.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
So this is – so you're sent to you've been cutting your face.
Yeah.
You've been getting in fights.
Right.
You're sent to a boarding school. Where is the boarding school?
It's in the San Bernardino Mountains.
So you're sent to a boarding school in the San Bernardino Mountains. And what is that like? Who drove you there?
My parents drove me
there. How was
that
drive?
They told me I was just going to tour it. I said, we're just going to go check it out.
Did they have you pack your bags or anything?
No, they packed it. I didn't realize
it. You didn't know the
bag
was in the trunk?
They must have been in the trunk, yeah.
So they tricked you?
Yeah, for sure. But I heard much later that they did this to a lot, and that's how they did this to most of the students.
This is so when your parents called CEDU and said, "Listen, we've got to do something. Our kid's cutting his face. He's getting in fights." They're like, "Here's what you do: pack his bags, put it in the trunk, tell him it's for a tour, and then we're going to kidnap him."
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people there. They, you know, sometimes they hired these guys, these goons that would come in the middle of the night and grab the kid and just.
That's Sea-Doo? I heard about that.
They'd grab them and they'd like cuff. I don't know if they cuff them or they'd do something to restrain them in the car and drive them up the fucking mountain.
Because you have no rights as a kid, I guess.
No, like, absolutely not. Some kids were there on court orders. It was bizarre. So, it was a really weird mix. But then there were some really like affluent people. Like I heard Paris Hilton was there at one point, very briefly. So it's just this really bizarre mix of
Bette Midler people. Center kid there, Roseanne Barr center
yes.
kid there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you get there with your parents, and does someone come out to greet you or?
They had these and everybody there. It looked like it was like the fucking. It was like I don't know how to describe. I mean, sort of like a Stepford Wives sort of thing, where everyone looked like they were all clearly drinking the Kool-Aid. Everyone had the same haircut, and they wore the same shit. It wasn't uniform, but they all had the same sort of structure to the dress code, and it was just bizarre.
Cultish.
Yeah, it was very cultish.
So everyone's kind of dressed the same. Some people come out to your parents' car to greet you?
We pull up, and then we walk toward... Yeah, someone greeted us at the car. I think someone from the... some counselor, one of the counselors. I can't remember who it was. And then it was a woman.
Okay.
And then they had me go with this student, and he showed me around the school and told me a little bit about it, and it just sounded fucking bizarre. I thought it was like a scared straight thing. I was like, oh, man, when I go back, I'm not fucking up again. I'm not coming here.
Wow.
And then after the tour, I went back to the administration building, and I went and I got in the room with my parents, and that's when they let me know that I – that they were leaving me there.
What did they say?
They told me that they were sorry and that they didn't know what else to do. And looking back, I get it. I totally get it. They didn't know what else to do with me. But
they didn't know.
No, they didn't know
what this place was. They didn't know.
No, they didn't realize
where they were leaving you.
Exactly. And I said fuck you, and then I stormed out. And they left, and then that was it. And then I was there for, about 3 years.
When you stormed out, did they grab you or something?
The kid was there, and he just sort of walked with me. And then he walked me up to the dorm, and then my bags were waiting up there for me. Oh, no, I got strip searched first. I got strip searched.
Fuck. So you tell your parents, hey, fuck you, man.
Yeah.
This is fucked. You walk out.
Yeah.
Someone strip searched.
Yeah,
so they're
hey,
come
so,
this
way. We walked up to the dorm, and then once I calmed down, they're like, all right, let's go back down to the house. And this house, by the way, it's such a weird mix of it's this gorgeous cabin in the woods, but all this fucked up shit about it that surrounds it. But it's this cabin that the Houstons. It was like Angelica Houston when she was like 12 or 13 and her dad and Walter
what?
And John Houston. And they had this gorgeous cabin in the woods. So that's where the school was founded, was in this guy. He's like a cult leader named Mel Wasserman.
Okay.
And he started this school.
Was he there? Was he still alive at that time?
He visited a two or three times. And he was he had a real cult leader aura about him, but not in the traditional, more of like a... someone that like more like an evangel like he was collecting some people. He did it more for them at that point. I don't know how it started. Maybe it was for power. I'm sure every cult leader has their different motivations.
Yeah.
But his at that time was strictly about was financial.
He just wanted to get rich.
He wanted to get rich,
and he was doing it by creating this boarding school for boys and girls there.
Yeah. It was okay. Co-ed.
How did they keep you guys from fucking?
They did. Well, I didn't. But everyone it seemed like every week someone else they had all these different this lingo, like you would cop out for dirt meant you were virtually telling on yourself. Every week you had to write a dirt list. And then you'd write like I didn't have my feet on the floor at 6 a.m. or I didn't dust underneath my shelf today and then all the way up to I had sex with Susie down by the farm and so it's like every week and they'd have these raps that were like these 3-hour intense primal scream therapy sessions where you'd have to like hash it out with people so like there was no violence any altercations had to be taken care of in these raps. So if you had a problem with someone, you had to wait until Monday, Wednesday, or Friday and request to have them in your rap, and then you would yell at them for whatever, however that you felt they wronged you or whatever.
So you'd scream at the top of your lungs.
Scream at the top of your lungs at someone you were having a problem with, or you would do work, which is, and doing work meant you'd scream towards the floor, not at the floor. You'd scream towards the floor. And so the first thing I ever did after I got strip searched, it just so happened that there was a rap immediately. That's just the way the schedule worked. So I had to go into my first rap after about 2 hours of being dropped off by my parents. And the first thing, and so this person next to me is just curled up in a ball, right? And they're just sort of rocking back and forth and just sobbing a little, like kind of just like softly sobbing. And then it just gets louder and it builds. And meanwhile, there's someone that gets up across the room because you can't yell at someone directly next to you. You can't talk to someone next to you. You have to get up and switch seats with someone across the room. So someone gets up, goes across the room and starts yelling at the kid next to me. All the while, this girl next to me on my right is slowly rocking back and forth, sobbing, and then just starts screaming at the top of her lungs, "I hate you, Mom." Just all this fucked up shit. I can't remember exactly what it was. And then just all this like snot and spit. I don't know if you've ever screamed while sobbing at the top of, like, with every ounce of your being while keeled over in like, in a ball, in a chair, it just empties all the fluids out of your body. Yeah. So someone else starts throwing all these Kleenexes right as she starts screaming. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? They just start throwing all these Kleenexes on the floor. And then I realized it was to catch all this spit and snot just flowing out. And there's just these air pockets, these huge, I've never seen anything like it.
Air pockets?
Because it's just this waterfall of mucus.
It's
the most disgusting thing I've ever seen.
So it's like when you pour salt on a slug.
Yes.
You're watching this bubble of primal ooze spraying out of them.
And so this is something that would happen 3 times a week. And there were three or four people that did it in that particular rap.
What were you thinking, man?
I fucked up. I'm fucked. I'm here for 2.5 years. I got to try and find a way to get out of here. I'm either going to run away. Okay. Or I'm going to convince my parents that this is not for me.
How could you communicate with your parents?
You have to wait 2 weeks before your first phone call to them. And then there's faculty in the room while you talk to them. So if you say one thing untoward about the school, they hang up on you.
What?
And you're not allowed to talk, and then you lose your phone privileges. So I ended up running away after about 6 or 7 months. I ran away.
Where'd you go?
I went down to the nearest payphone and called my parents so I wasn't supervised, you know, and tried to get them to pull me out. And then they said they weren't. My mom's like, sorry, I'm not. You have to stay there.
Could you have just left? Would you have been legally?
No, I was only 15.
So you
14.
If you left, the cops would have picked you up and brought you back.
Well, a lot of people ran away. So it turns out that, all right, so most people, when they ran away, one day they just would be gone. Like there'd be, you wake up, there's work crews. So it's like, and everyone's in a peer group. God, there's I'm all over the fucking place. All right, let me think about how to.
You run away, you're 15, you have no legal rights.
Right.
So that means that this place that has now been exposed as a cult, an abusive cult, bankrupt from lawsuits. That means that you are going to be taken back to a psychologically abusive, physically abusive cult.
Yeah.
No escape. So you can't get away. You are in you would be, if you left, if you hung up on your mom and just kept going down the mountain or wherever you were at, you're still a fugitive. You're a fugitive that will be brought back to this place.
And everyone, all right, so people were constantly escaping and then brought back after a various amount of time. So, you know, after a week, someone would come back, and then one day they'd be in a wrap, and they would be on what's called a full-time. If you ever broke a major agreement, they don't call them rules, they call them agreements, because
there's
all this lingo. But anyway, if you had sex, or you split, or you did anything major, or you didn't even, or if you just didn't work on yourself, and they thought that you were just coasting by and not screaming at the floor enough or whatever, then they would put you on what's called a full time, which means that from the minute you wake up, you're only allowed to talk to your big brother, which is the person you're paired up with when you first start, who's an older student.
Right.
And that's the only person other than staff that you're allowed to talk to, look at, and you're not allowed to laugh. You're not allowed to smile. You're not allowed to sing. And you just have to work all day, which means that it's usually on a stump. There was this big stump, and every day there'd be a kid on there with a pickaxe working on the stump, which was futile because it was there for years that no one ever was able to excavate this stump. It was the biggest tree stump I'd ever seen. So you did that all day, and then when you came inside, you had to do these writing assignments, which were like 3 pages each, which was, I hate my dad because, I hate my mom because, I'm sad because, I'm angry because, and then you write your life story and all this shit, and then you do dishes at night, and then you go to sleep, and you wake up the next day, and you do it all over again.
How many hours of sleep are you getting?
I think 6. Okay. Maybe 6. Okay. And then you were there for until the staff said, okay, you're done. And there was no time frame. It was just whenever they felt that you had done what you needed to do to get off your full time.
But when do you get released from the school itself?
Like, oh, it's a 2.5-year program. But if you split, so you go through the school program, which is known as your peer group, and that's all the students who are enrolled around the same 2 or 3 month period as you were. So my peer group started with about 20 students, and when we graduated, I think it was about 10. People were either pulled out or they dropped the peer group. So what you do is you go through these things called profites with your peer group, and that's once every 2 months. It's sort of like a rite of passage, this emotional growth 24-hour-long workshop, which were all based on chapters in Khalil Gibran's The Prophet.
Okay.
So there was the first one's called The Truth, and it's all about how the truth will set you free, and to the same degree you feel joy, to the same degree you feel sorrow, and you have and the staff is in there with you, and they're telling all their darkest secrets, and you're telling all of your, and it's all about truth, and you're divulging all the things you've ever done that you felt bad about. I was molested. I molested. I did this. I did that.
I let the dog lick mayonnaise off my cock.
I've heard shit like that. And then the staff had these fucked up disclosures. So these are the people who they hired to facilitate these. They weren't therapists. They weren't psychiatrists.
Right.
They were
untrained.
They were psychotic.
So what kind of
I heard guys who raped, one guy who lit a homeless guy on fire.
You heard that?
Yeah. Another one would strangle cats.
Is this, were they telling the truth?
Yeah, or
were they
absolutely, 1,000%.
So you're sitting in a room with these people who are your supervisors.
Yes.
And they're admitting to crimes that they should be in jail for.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Definitely.
And
it was insane. It was fucking insane.
And you're telling them your deepest secrets.
Yeah, because if you didn't, at least for me, the only motive, my biggest motivation was I don't want to stay here a fucking day longer than I have to. And if I need, and so does that, if that means that I got to go through the motions and I got to do what's expected of me, then I will do whatever the fuck that means. And I'm not dropping a peer group. I'm staying another. Because if you drop a peer group, that adds 6 months to your sentence.
God.
Yeah. And so then if you split, like my buddy, my best friend going through there was originally in my peer group and ended up staying an extra year longer, or a year and a half, I think.
Jesus.
Because he kept leaving. He kept splitting, or he kept fucking people. And then he would get sent away to these 42-day programs in the woods, like Ascent and all those shit, like Outward Bound type places.
Okay, yeah.
You had to like survive, like cook rats and shit to live and just hike through the fucking woods for 42 days and then come back. And you find out, and when you come back, it's like you just added time to your sentence. Now you're in another peer group and you have to go through the same bullshit.
Holy,
it's a nightmare.
Shit, man.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Now, when I was researching this, it appears that there were 2 kids who vanished.
Yeah, so all the time. So, like, I know students who killed themselves there. There was a girl who, she was in the peer group below me, and she had anorexia, bulimia. And she slit her own throat in the dorm and died. And
with what?
With scissors. I think it was scissors.
Oh,
and then there was another kid who jumped off a cliff. He lived, but it was fucked up, man. Then there were people, because it was up on the mountain, so there was either the front entrance, which you have a much better chance of getting caught or being seen, or you go down what was known as the backside, which is virtually just down a mountain. And there were a couple kids who were never found. They split, And there was always legend had it that they had fallen down the backside and were never found and died. But then about 5 or 6 years ago, these articles came out and it was uncovered that there was a serial molester and killer, this murderer, who was roommates and partners with one of the therapists, this outside therapist who would come and visit once every couple months. And he confessed, God, what the fuck was his name? I can't remember. It came out 5 years ago. It was huge news for everyone in the CEDU community.
And so...
So it turns out that he was connected to one of the, there was in particular, one of the kids who went to the middle school there, and we always thought he died going down the backside. But they think that this guy was the guy who killed him. And he would come, and he, while I was there, this guy would come up every 2 months. I don't remember what he looked like. I never met him, I don't think.
A serial fucking killer was coming up there. Listen, man. Holy
there
shit.
It was insane. They didn't do any screening. There was no in-depth interviews. Like, this is an important position that people are applying for, and they didn't think maybe we should see these people's credentials. Do they have any training? Do they have experience or schooling or anything? They have no education in this.
They killed those kids.
Oh, yeah.
They killed those kids.
Well, I mean, three of my very close friends, it was, I don't want to say, I don't know if it was the school. I mean, a lot of people were there for, these aren't good, great kids who are well-adjusted that got sent there in the first place. But I don't know. A lot of them killed themselves immediately following CEDU.
So they left CEDU and killed themselves.
Yeah. I remember my big brother, one of my dorm heads, one of my very close friends there, and he hung himself about 6 or 7 months after leaving.
Sorry,
another,
man.
No, it's all right. And then another kid who jumped off a cliff about 3 or 4 months after leaving CEDU. So it's like, I don't know. A lot of these people hold on so tightly, much like we were discussing, and here's a good tie into the Comedy Store, is a lot of these people that hold on so tightly to how they feel they've been wronged, and it holds them back in life.
Right.
So I always make sure that for whatever reason, I try not to, I just look at it as something that I experience. I'm not trying to hold on that tight to this.
Right. I can see that you don't, it doesn't seem like you are,
but I have nightmares. Sure. I have nightmares every week about it for sure.
Yeah, man, this is PTSD. Like have you thought about maybe getting some therapy or
talking? I went to therapy. Yeah, I mean, I've been in since, oh God, I mean, I did so much fucking therapy up there.
It's right.
But now I need therapy about the therapy. Some of the some of these exercises they made you do were so insane.
Like
they were
what?
So intense. Fuck, man. There was oh God, they would do, it was a lot of similar tactics to prisoner of war. Like there would be sleep deprivation and fuck, I'm so inarticulate. What sound? The sound where they play the same song at a really.
Oh yeah, I read about that. I don't know what that's called, but I read about that. What song would they play?
A lot of the same songs. I can't. I don't ever want to hear Imagine ever again. I can't.
If John it comes Lennon.
On, yeah, I can't ever hear that again.
So they would play Imagine.
Yeah,
I'm not
going
to sing.
No,
it, but...
it's fine. But yeah, they would play that a lot, and then a lot of John Denver. I can't stand John Denver.
Oh my God! Oh my God!
Oh, no. Is that a nightmare or what?
Oh, fuck.
Fucking that alone.
Holy
that
shit.
That in itself is a fucking nightmare.
So you are in.
I want to live.
You aren't allowed to sleep. So no. So you're not allowed to sleep.
Right.
You are in a 24-hour.
Yeah, and the staff is just berating you. You're a whore. You're a monster. You're just going to go out here and get gang fucked. And you're a little they would say that to the girls. And then the guys would be like, you're going to be dead in a week. You're a piece of shit. You're nothing. And then in the morning, they try and build you back up.
And while that's happening, they're playing Take Me Home, Country Road.
Yeah, no, so they would play The Long and Winding Road, or He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother. That they would play that constantly. Look What They've Done to My Soul. Like all these fucking weird songs. It was terrifying.
Listen, man.
the Rocky song they play, and like you'd have to like they'd say you're fighting for your life.
You got to write a screenplay about this.
It'd be a good show.
This is a this if this why is this this is a series. This should be a series. This is like Lost. This is the most I've never heard before. You told me about this. I'd never heard of it.
It's pretty crazy.
What happened to the people who were running this thing?
Oh, they're on Facebook. You can find them.
What?
Yeah, it's fucking crazy.
No, they're not in jail. There's no. What are they doing now?
Oh, fucking, they're on Facebook. They're fucking posting photos of what they just ate at Chipotle or whatever. I don't fucking know.
What about what was the main guy's name?
Well, Mel Wasserman.
What happened to Wasserman?
I don't know. I wonder if he's dead. He's gotta be. He's either incredibly old or he's dead. I don't know what happened to him. You know what the best fucking... All right, so wait. This is the only other one I'll say. There was one that always sticks with me more than any other exercise we had to do in one of these prof feats. And this one actually was... The last two prof feats are actually three-day workshops, which you get like 3 hours sleep on each day.
Jesus.
And this one, one was three-day, one was five-day. And in the five-day one, towards the end, you had to do... They called it the lifeboat. And they picked two students, and I was one of them. And you sit in a chair... And then the other guy sat in the chair next to you. And you're in a lifeboat. And all the other students are sitting around you. And you can only pick one student, make it on the lifeboat, and everyone else dies. And then you have to tell them. You have to look everyone in the eye and tell them why they die. You would be like, you die because I think you're selfish or whatever the fuck. And it's like everyone's just sobbing and looking at you in the eye, and you have to tell them. And it reminded me a lot of me doing these fucking lineups. I have to fucking tell people. Sorry, man. I don't have any spots for you this week.
You know what you should do, man? Instead of telling people you don't have spots for them, you should just call them up and play John Denver. And they'll just know. So real quick, man, so we can connect everything.
Yeah, sure.
So you leave this place. How old are you when you get out?
16.
And what do you do?
I went back to high school. Go back into high school. I mean, shit, it was quite a change. It's hard to adjust because also thrown into this public school. And I was stuck in this place where you weren't allowed, if you even said the words, the Rolling Stones, you'd have to do dishes. You couldn't listen to music or any music that had anything to do with drugs or rock or sex or anything. So it was like you could listen to John Denver and fucking Otmar Liebert or some shit.
Fuck.
And that's what they would play. But it was just sort of like culture shock. It was like I was in a fucking coma. It was like I was in some sort of fucking David Lynch dream. That was my own lodge. Yeah. That was my other black lodge.
So you come out of this thing, how long again? 2 years? 2 years?
About 2.5 to 3 years.
2.5 to 3 years of the most incredible psychic abuse.
Yeah.
That like prisoner of war level psychic abuse. What did you say to your folks? How did you?
I didn't tell them about it.
You didn't tell them?
No. Because I tried to at first. And then once someone made this documentary about it, and then my mom via Facebook or something, that's where she heard about it. And then she saw it, and that's when she really apologized. She's like, I had no idea. I was like, that's okay. What are you going to do?
So you're in public school.
Yeah.
And you got to just pretend like you're everything's okay.
Yeah. And it was just this, and it was like, it was a school in the valley. I didn't know I didn't know anybody. Ice Cube went there. It was like, Taft High School.
All right.
And so, I don't know. I didn't know anybody. Plus, on top of that, I didn't know who the fuck anybody was. Like, I didn't understand, and I was still like,
you've been a
wasn't
time
sure
warp.
Who the yeah. I felt like I just felt so out of place, man. On so many levels, I felt really out of place because I had just gotten out too, so I didn't know shit, and I was wearing like I didn't know how to dress. I didn't know how to act. It was weird, but it was good. But I think it all worked out.
It worked out.
Yeah, it worked out.
Because you graduate from high school.
Yeah,
college.
I did a lot of college, but nothing. I took a lot of film classes and stuff that interests me, music and film.
And now you're at the Comedy Store, and it's so weird. This is kind of, there's like a strange parallel there, isn't there?
Definitely.
Wow.
They're two. I consider them both my Black Lodge. They're both fucking lodges, man. You're nuts.
But the difference is, man, you're turning the Comedy Store into this. And what your energy in that place.
Oh, it's totally group effort. I really appreciate that. But it's just, I'm lucky to have all these amazing comics that call in every week. And I honestly just try and put together the best fucking lineup I can. I just want to do it based on who I think are the funniest or the biggest draws. And then, like I said, towards the end of the lineups, I just want to make sure that I give those young comics a chance to develop just like the comics who came before them.
You're doing it, man. I mean, it's really cool.
The only one I know that I talk to that understands what it's like. And so I am so lucky that it's
anytime,
someone I respect.
Listen,
so
man,
fucking
any,
much.
Thank you. And anytime you start, anytime you need to talk to somebody, give me a call, man, because I've been there. I've been in that building for many years, and I've been where you're at. And not many people, I think, understand what that's like.
I know.
So, wow, though, man. Cool. Thank you so much for sharing this with me.
Absolutely.
An amazing story. I feel like we just only scratched the surface,
man. Oh, dude, thanks,
man,
for having thank me. You. This is great.
Great. Wonderful. Well, guys, listen, go see Adam at the Comedy Store. Go see him through his awesome lineups. Go to the Comedy Store. And thank you very much for being on the show, man.
Thanks so much, Don.
Hare Krishna. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this episode, give us a nice rating on iTunes, won't you? You can follow Adam on Twitter by going to @AdamEgett, @AdamEgett. And a big thank you to Casper.com for sponsoring this episode. Go to Casper.com/FamilyHour. Use offer code FamilyHour to get $50 off a brand new mattress. Don't forget to bookmark our Amazon portal. And don't forget to bookmark your heart, because that's where you should be living from, my angels and angelettes. I'll see you next time. Hare Krishna.